All right, we're gonna hopefully do all of. Believe it or not, we're gonna cook tonight. If I have any luck, we're gonna do chapter 6 and 7, as it is all one story. I have no idea why Archbishop Stephen Langton broke up the chapter 7 the way he did. Makes no sense to the best I could tell whatsoever. What's that? Yeah, they translate that differently than we do, you know. How our Ruach HaKodesh, which was a communication device, really, or inspiration, became one of the three. I don't know. I just don't know why they personified. I think like they personified many things.
It's just another aspect of the Godhead.
But it's a noun, not a crazy version. I think maybe they just like personifications, you know. We like non-personifications. They like personifications. I don't know what to tell you. So anyway, so we're going to cover a lot of ground. We actually did a little bit of chapter 8 some weeks ago, and we're going to get to next week, just to give you a mind what we're going to get next week. God sends Elisha. That this is next week's year, just to let you know what's coming up, although I'll try not to, this time hopefully I won't forget it, to put a bulletin board item. He sends Elisha on the worst possible shlichut, how do you translate shlichut, mission that you could possibly imagine. And Elisha cries his way through the entire thing. It's a miserable shlichut mission that we're going to see in chapter 8 the next time. And what's interesting is the same one that Eliyahu was given, that Eliyahu refused to do, essentially. But Elisha bites his, essentially
all
bites
right,
the bullet
you
and does
tell
it.
Us.
No, I can't. I can't. There's a tag. There's so many people here I want to make sure we had. He goes to Melech Aram and he causes a revolution in Aram. And that revolution will cause a great destruction in Israel. And he can't stand it. And he cries all his way through. He barely could say it. They essentially nearly have to torture him to get the information out of him. And it's really very sad. And that's next time.
Hard now,
what's that?
He'd be crying hard
about Syria?
Now.
Well, things come and go. We're going to meet somebody today. Where an old friend is going to come back without a name today. So we'll meet him a little bit and we'll see what the story is. But anyway, let me start without so much. I sound like a product placement person. We're on verse 24 of chapter 6. Vayihi Achreichen. This is a pretty sad story also. Chapter 6 of 2 Kings, verse 24, or Malachim Bet, Perek Vav, Pasuk Chaf Dal. Good evening, good evening. Hi, we have some extra Tanakhs. We have the English, we should have, we have some Hebrew English Tanakhs. Can we see where they are? What happened to them?
There were like four of them. Or five of them.
Oh, and people are using some of them. Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah, I know. I think people are using them, actually. I didn't notice. I think we have to get some. Wow, if we have this kind of attendance on a regular basis, we'll have to get some more.
Good problem.
Baruch Hashem. Right, yes, yes. Vayihi achreichen vayikbots ben Hadad melech Aram et kol machanehu. So it was after these things. That Ben-Hadad, who's the king of Syria, who we've met many times before, Vayal Vayatzal Shamon, and he besieges the capital city of the north, that's Samaria. It's Malachim Bet, Perek Vav, Pasuk Chaf Dalet, chapter 6, verse 24. Now, there's some confusing things here, because if you remember the very last verse of the previous, that is, we go back one verse, there was just a case where Elisha was very successful at suppressing the attack of the Aramites, and it says that Aram at that point, which is modern day Syria, never came again or would not come again into Eretz Yisrael. And then the very next pasuk, what's that? Did you have a question? And then the very next pasuk, it says, and here they come again. So the question is there a lie here? Is there something dishonest going on? I thought it said they never came again. In the next verse, they said they did come again. So, first of all, you may notice that there's a break in between those two psukim. There's a little pay if you have the Mikro Kedol. Otherwise, you'll have actually a separation. You should have a separation between verse 23 and verse 24. If you don't have it, it's a mistake. You should have it. These are two separate stories. Now, what about Vayihi Achreichen? Generally speaking, we assume that Vayihi Achreichen means right after what came before in the previous pasuk, which it may mean in many cases, but in other cases it may not. This is a document, what we're looking at here, and I use the word very cautiously. No one should, chas v'shalom, think that I'm talking about documentary hypotheses here. documentary apophysis only applies to the five books of Moses. When it comes to the rest of the books in Nevi'im, it's well understood that there were documents. Chazal said there were documents. Essentially, Elisha wrote his own set of books, and then Yirmiyahu came and he put them together as a story later on in his life. So you say there were documents, and you raise a certain specter of a lack of faith in the Torah, a lack of faith in God. But here what you're talking about is a series of stories that is available to Yirmiyahu, and he does not have the chutzpah enough to change these stories greatly, so he takes them as they are. My guess is that that verse 24 did not originally come right after verse 23, but Yirmiyahu, or perhaps Elisha later on in his life, or one of Elisha's students, decided to put one after the other. And what we've shown, and I don't want to, of course, go through it again, but what we've shown is that each story about Elisha, each miracle, and there are probably about 20 miracles that he pulls off, each one tells a certain story about his success. First he's good to the people, he gets the people to help each other, and then he starts reinvigorating the school of prophets, and then he gets friendly with the king, and then he's friendly with the Zakanim, with the elders. So each one tells a specific story about his success. They're thematically linked, not chronologically linked. The biggest proof for that, by the way, is if you remember in the previous section, or I will state it in for those who aren't here, the previous section, when the king asks for help from Elisha, he calls him Avi, my father. That wasn't one of Ahav's children. No way would Ahav's children, certainly Ahaziah was already dead, Yehoram certainly would never have called, he did not have that kind of relation with Elisha, so probably that was a story that was actually in the future by one of Yehu's children, and Yehu, of course, were elected, quote-unquote, by Elisha, so they have a very good relationship. Here we're going to see that the king wants to kill Elisha. That's a completely different relationship between the king and Elisha, which is up to this verse in the previous section from chapter 6 to verse 23. The king is in love with Elisha, and he calls him my father, and only will do exactly what Elisha tells him to do. Here we're going to see that the king wants to kill him. So what that shows you is that it's not the same king. I mean, unless he's schizophrenic, which is always possible, it's not the same king. And therefore, what you have, kind of proof positive, is that you're dealing with a leap of time. In my opinion, you're dealing with a leap backwards. First, in the previous section, we told the story in the future, because there was an important point that they wanted to make about Elisha. And now we're jumping backwards in time in order to get to the next point about Elisha, and we'll see exactly what that thematic point is. But it's important to recognize that v'hir v'hi acharechein does not necessarily mean what came in the previous verse. It depends on what book you're in. Of course, many times it does mean that. Like if you have the book of Esther and it says, Vayihi Akara Dvayma Eila, that was a book that was really clearly written by one person at one time. It was written by Esther and then it was modified by Anshek Tzedekah. But by and large, you can see that the book flows from piece to piece. So when you have Vayihi Akara Dvayma Eila, Zacharet Vashti Vetasher Asata, so you know that's after what Achashverus did in the previous chapter. When you're dealing with a book as complex as Malachim, Vayihi Acharechein does not necessarily mean that it comes after the previous verse, merely that this story is put in here for the purpose of the theme, and the best we can do is try to figure out what the theme is. And that, with that, I'm going to continue on. So Ben-Hadad comes, which also solves the problem of how come in the verse it says, previous verse says Ben-Hadad will never come again, and here he comes again. So the answer is, in my humble opinion, this is a story that happened probably 20 years in the past, and we're simply leaping back in time. Vayhi Rav Gadol B'Shomron V'hinei Tzarim Aleha. So there was a great famine. Of course, famine and pestilence usually doesn't happen so much because of lack of food. It happens because of war. Ad Heyot Rosh Chamor B'Shmonim Kesef, until the head of a donkey cost 80 silver pieces, and Rova Hakav Divyonim B'Chamishim Kesef. A rova kav is probably not that much. A small pile of bird dew, bird droppings. In fact, if you notice, the way it's written is chir yonim. And I have to tell you, even in modern Hebrew, that's a curse. People who live in Israel know that chet resh hay is an Arabic curse that's taken into Israelis. Israelis, especially in the army, use that word a lot, and it means poo-poo, in a much worse sense. So here also is the term, obviously, even by Yirmiyahu's time, was a negative term, and therefore, probably in Elisha's time, it wasn't a negative term, so they used the word Chir Yonim. It probably became a curse word by the time of Yirmiyahu, so he switched the read from Chir Yonim to Div Yonim, which is what we read, just to make it not sound so gross. Chazal point out here, by the way, that when they mean the head of a donkey, it doesn't mean counting a donkey, it means actually the head of a donkey, which they were eating at the time. That is essentially the only thing that was left to eat during this pestilence was the head of a donkey. And if you think that's bad, what they're eating, you're going to see what they're going to eat soon, and you're going to get even more disgusted. But essentially, when people start eating the heads of donkeys, so humanity starts to exit stage left, and that's what we're going to see is going on here. Which means if you were the rich of the rich, you can maybe get your hands on the head of a donkey. So the king of Israel, now his name is never mentioned here, which also gives you the indication, his name is absent from the whole chapter, also gives you the indication that he's one of Ahab's kids, not Yehu's kids, because Yehu's kids were sometimes mentioned by name, but Ahab's kids never, because Elisha didn't talk to them. This is pretty sad. Hoshia Adoni Hamelech. So a woman cries out and says, "Save me." Vayomer al Yoshiach Adonai me'ayin Oshiach. If God won't save you, do you think I can? Which is a loaded religious concept. It's hard to know what to make out of that. Is that a frum thing to say or a non-frum thing to say? If it's a frum thing to say, then maybe you could say what he's saying is, you got to go pray to God because I can't help you. If it's a non-frum thing to say, then it means something like, look what God did to you, and if you think God, and if God's doing this to you, I certainly can't help you out, my hands are tied, which is a blame it on God type of situation. This, by the way, for those who remember the battle against Edom, this smacks very much, or Moab, this smacks very much of Ahab's second son, Yehoram, who believed in God, but Elisha didn't want to have anything to do with him. Because if it was Ahab's first son, then he wouldn't be worshiping to Hashem. He wouldn't be speaking about Hashem, he'd be speaking about the Baal. So this sounds like Yehoram, a guy who has religious problems, and I think here one gets an indication. It's hard to say if this is a good thing to say or not a good thing to say.
Well, regardless, he's not saying the Baal.
Yeah, correct. And we saw that Yehoram was walking in the right direction. But there's something, to my sense, there's something lacking here. Al Yoshiach Adonai Umeayin Oshiach Hamina Goren Hamina Yaakov. You think I'm going to get food out of the Goren is the granary. You think I'm going to get it out of the Yaakov, which is the wine pressing place. So essentially, he tells her to take a walk. He doesn't really tell her to take a walk. He just tells her there's nothing he could do. Vayomer lo hamelech malach. What's that?
Without even knowing what the problem is.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, exactly right. We're going to notice that which should strike you exactly the opposite of Shlomo with the women with the two babies. And you'll see why I'm saying that, because there's about to be two women with two babies in a second. Vayomer lo hamelech malach. So I guess the king, either she doesn't leave him alone. We don't know. He just told her to go away, essentially. And now he's saying, Vayomer lo hamelech malach. And then he says to her, what exactly is your case? What happened in between, it's hard to say. Did he have a sense of guilt that he felt that maybe he should get involved anyway? Because we did see that Yehoram had some good qualities also, if it is Yehoram. The other possibility is that she wouldn't go away. And she says, I want to be heard. So he says, what do you want? Vatomer ha'isha hazot, and she says, this woman, the woman that's speaking points to another woman, says, Amrai Eli said to me, Tzni et b'necha v'nochleno hayom, give us your son, and we'll eat him today. The et b'ni nochal machar, and we'll eat my son tomorrow. Vanivashel et b'ni vanochalehu, so we cooked up my son and we ate him. Va'omare leho bayom ha'acher, and then on the second day, t'ni b'nech v'nochalena, so I said, let's eat your son today. Va'tachbi et b'na, but she hid her son so he could not be eaten. It's a pretty miserable story, right? So there's all kinds of issues here that I'm not going to get involved in, because I want to cover like the entire flow of this chapter and a half. One question is, was he alive, the second son? Why is she hiding? If the son is dead, then why is she hiding him? So there is some thought that the idea was that they were not only going to questions, you know, sure. it wasn't just a question of consumption, it was a question of killing and consumption. There is that possibility that it is raised, I think, by various mafarshim. However, I don't think that's the simple read. I don't think we need to take it that far. I think the easier answer is that she hid her son so she could eat, so she'd get more. Do you see what I'm saying? That is, so she wouldn't have to share the next day. And then the question is purely a now, what should shock you, what shocks the king, is the complete insanity of the situation. I'm going for a court case. I'm asking for a court case to discuss this issue. It's a matter of pure insanity, and I think that's what the Navi is trying to draw here. what makes sense makes no sense. Well, I guess it is a good legal case. She did promise half of the food, etc. But the very matter is insanity. The very matter that a woman could speak this way is insanity. And the very matter that two people would be conversing, the very matter that one would publicly go to the king and ask for a monetary decision based on, I mean, what was she expecting? That the king was going to cough up half a kid or cough up the money for a kid? It's not at all clear exactly what is desired here, and the truth is it shouldn't be, because it's pure insanity. And what I was saying before is when you got a whiff that humanity was going out the door, so humanity does go out the door. Of course, we heard stories in the Holocaust, not of Jews and cannibalism, but they did tell stories. Whether it happened or not, I mean, I couldn't say. One certainly hopes that it never happened among the Jewish people, that the Jewish people resorted to cannibalism. But there were stories I specifically remember. I don't remember where I heard them, but where people were thrown out by Nazi guards in front of prisoners of war, Russian captives of war, and cannibalism was actually something that was done in the something that took place in the death camps.
Well, we read about it in Eicha.
Right. In Eicha, you could hope to imagine. You're not only reading in Eicha, you also read in the Tochacha. In Devarim, the question is, in Eicha, you could hope that he's being poetic. You could hope that he is just describing some imaginary scenario, because there is a lot of metaphors in Eicha. Here, this is just a simple narrative, and it's told in such a matter-of-fact way that that's what makes it, I think, so chilling. Mm-hmm. It's a matter-of-fact. And that's why I said it bounces, it's directly the opposite of the story with Shlomo, where you had two mothers that were vying for the life of a child. There was a death of a child accidentally, and there were two mothers vying over the life of the child. Now, as we did, there's all kinds of complications, and why was one mother willing to split the baby or not, but at least at some point, there were two mothers vying for the life of a child. And here what you have is a similar case where two women, you know, just from the street come and they vie for the death of a child, one also to split the child, as it were. So I think to a certain degree, it's a mockery, really. Not a mockery, but not an irony. I'm not sure how to describe it in English.
Cartoon.
Just I'm saying it's there to stand against the beginning of Sefer Melachim to show you how absurd things get. And I have to tell you, who knows how many times stuff like this happens? As I've mentioned many times in this class, sometimes the Torah, all it says, Vayhi Rav Baretz, and that's it. That's all you hear about. It's really all you hear about, because the Torah doesn't want to go into details unless they're absolutely necessary for the moral point of the story, which here they are. It's hard to say when this kind of things happens, but war is certainly a miserable business, and every once in a while you see humanity go out the window, and that's what's happening here. But more on that, and I'll start to be pulpity rather than Bible-y. So let me continue on. Vayhi kishmo ha-melech et divrei ha-yishav vayikra v'kadav hu over al-choma vayar ha'am v'inei asak al-bsaro mi-bayit. It's an interesting pasuk. I'll just focus a few things. So he rips his clothes, and what the people say, since he was up on the wall, they saw that he was wearing sackcloth underneath his clothes. That's what the word mibayit means, inside. It doesn't mean in the house. Mibayit simply means inside. Radak mentions that, and that's correct in Hebrew. Mibifnim. Now, the question is, what is it really trying to tell about the king? It looks like the king knew his situation, so he's wearing sackcloth on the inside. He was a little bit of an Oreo. On the outside, he was wearing his kingly clothes, but when he saw, I guess perhaps, even in a positive sense, maybe he was trying to show the people that there was still possibility for hope, even though inside he was mourning. And here he rips his clothes, and now the people see that he's mourning on the inside as well, and this is probably where despair sets in. So who are you going to blame? Here again, this is kind of a classic Yehoram issue, because you're not quite good and you're not quite bad. You mention God's name, but you sort of accuse God of letting this happen to you rather than try to fix the problem yourself. You rip your clothes when you see that your people are in such a dire strait, but then when you want to blame somebody, who are you going to blame? You blame the prophet. So let's go blame the prophet in verse Lamed Aleph.
Is this famine being attributed to Ben-Hadad?
Yeah, this is because of the siege. Because of the siege.
One wonders why Yehoram didn't march out with his army to fight.
Well, Ben-Hadad, if you remember, at the time of Naaman, what I'm going to show you is this is the time of Naaman. He was the guy who had leprosy, mm-hmm. who was cured of leprosy, And at that point, Aram had come back. In Achab's time, Aram was really pushed down below. And Achab didn't wipe them out. He was punished because of it. And what we saw a few chapters ago was that Aram had had a resurgence and started to actually attack inside Eretz Israel. My feeling is that is this time, and Israel is not in any position whatsoever to attack. Mm-hmm. And Aram is clearly the superior force, and there was no way to ride out and meet them. This is like Helm's Deep. For those who like Lord of the Rings, instead of they're hopelessly outnumbered. Yeah, yeah, sure, because they had a wizard. Oh, but I guess that's maybe the difference between a wizard and a prophet. What's that? Vayomer ko yaseh li Elohim. What's that? Right, if only. Vayomer ko yaseh li Elohim v'cho yosifim yamod rosh alisha ben shmar alav hayom. It's a classic case of when you have nobody else to blame. Blame the rabbi, so they're going to take the rabbi's head off, and that should solve apparently all of his problems. He obviously feels that Elisha is the one to blame for this type of thing, or once again, instead of looking inwards for a solution, he is looking out towards God as to blame, and who, you can't kill God, so you kill God's messenger. This is sort of a classic Yehoram thing, which is why I'm convinced it's Yehoram. The Elisha yoshev beveito vazkinim yoshvim ito. But here's something very interesting. He's sitting in his house in Shomron, by the way. He's in the capital city. And the Zakanim of the city are sitting in front of him. Now, these aren't prophets. Prophets are called B'nai Nevi'im. Zakanim means the elders of the city. Which means, again, you have this weird situation where he's actually making a great deal of progress. You never have Eliyahu sitting with the Zakanim of the city. But here's Elisha, and he's sitting around talking advice, talking religion, with the elders of the city, which gives you a good indication of what Elisha was able to accomplish. Vayishlach ish milafanav. Now here this pasuk becomes very, this is one of those things, Herb, that you really hate because it's all vague, but I have to tell you it's vague on purpose. What you're trying to get, I believe what the author is trying to do, if you notice pasuk 32 is very long. It's incredibly long. That's done that way in order to give you a sense that things are happening so fast that I don't know who's sending what to whom, why, and where. Here what I would call intentional ambiguity, and I'll read you the ambiguity and you'll see what I mean. We could spend a whole hour on this, looking at the various mafarshim as they try to solve the ambiguity. I'll solve it in the simplest way, but I want you to understand that I would like, you know, to impress on you that the intention is ambiguity because of the horror situation that they're all in. The Elisha yoshev beitov askenim yoshvim ito vayishlach ish milafanav, and he sends a man in front of him. Who's he? I got so many antecedents, I don't know who this is. The simplest translation is the king sends someone in front of him. The assumption is to kill Elisha. That is, he's sending a messenger to kill Elisha. That's the easiest translation. Biterem yavo, and there's a missing vav there. So says Radak, is probably correct, which means, and before he got there, that biterem yavo hamalach elav, before the messenger reached Elisha to kill him, the Hu Amar El Hashkinim, and he, that is Elisha, not right, not the messenger, but Elisha says to this Kenim, Hari'item Kishalach Ben Hamratzeh Hazel Asir Roshi, do you see that the son of the murderer is sending a messenger to take off my head? That also gives the impression that Jehoram, because the murderer here is probably Achav. Re'u Kivo Hamalach Sigru Adelet Ulchatevo Tobadelet. It's all a big jumble. It's a rush. Everybody is racing around trying to solve problems. He says, listen, as soon as you see the messenger, I want you to close the door in his face and press upon the door, which means hold the door shut. Halo kol raglei Adonav acharav. Because behold, the sound of the feet of his master is after him. Easiest translation, is that the king was running after the messenger after having sent the messenger, which means first the messenger runs. Then what Elisha says is, not only do I have a vision that this guy's coming to take off his head, you've got to delay him. Why? Because the king's coming right after him. The simplest translation of what's going on here, and you have to read a lot into the Pesukim, the simplest meaning, is that the king had second thoughts. That's the easiest translation. That is, why would you want to close the door until the king shows up, you know, 5 minutes after the messenger who was told to kill Elisha? This is not necessarily the correct interpretation, but the simplest interpretation is that Yehoram may have had, or whoever the king was, had second thoughts, felt bad about sending out his own people to kill Elisha, especially since he was surrounded by this Canaan, and he runs after him to save him, and Elisha knows that if he just keeps the killer out, the king will show up and he will tell the messenger not to stay his hand. Now I'm reading that into the pasuk because otherwise it's not clear why the king is running afterwards, what the holding of the door is, and why the door is being held. It's a gobbledygook, to be perfectly honest. And I think the sense is that there's so many people running and coming and going that you're trying to get a sense of breathlessness. That's my sense of the pasuk. Just look at the very size of the pasuk; it's three times the normal size of a verse. Odenim and Daberimam. While he's still talking with them, Behinei Amalach Yorei Lav, and here the messenger goes down to him. And I have to say, all you have to do is lose the aleph there, and what do you get if you lose the aleph from that word malach? And what do you get?
Couldn't the malach, who was an angel in Hebrew as well,
yeah,
couldn't they have used the word shaliach or messenger instead of an angel? An angel you read.
Yeah, it's certainly whenever you have the word malach, it's never clear whether you're talking about a flesh and blood messenger or a supernatural messenger. I want you to know something. You could read it that way. That is, the angel was coming to intercept. The only problem that you have is with the next word, which is Vayomer, and he says, Hine zotara meit Hashem. This evil, that is the famine, is coming from God. Ma uchil Hashem od. What hope do we have from God more? Which does not sound like something that the angel would say. Now, if you want to, though, you could say that the angel comes down in verse 33, and then Vayomer then is referring to the flesh and blood messenger that he sent. Because there's such a confusion of pronouns, it's hard to say who is doing what to whom. I don't think it's the easiest read to say that this is an angel, simply because I already have two characters. I already have a malach, which is a human malach, that the king sent. So I don't feel that I need to introduce the supernatural malach, although it's certainly not impossible. But what also is confusing is it doesn't look like it's the malach. Let's assume that the malach is the flesh and blood malach. It doesn't sound like him either. Why? Because the job of malach was to kill the guy. We would expect the next thing that would happen was the guys would have held up the door and tried to keep him out until the king came. But as far as we know, the king never shows up, at least doesn't show up here. And whoever this guy, this malach is, says, Hinei zotara meit Hashem, I recognize that this comes from God. Ma uchil Hashem od. What hope do we have from God anymore? That doesn't sound like the malach. The malach should have said, put your head on the block. I mean, that's what the malach should have said.
Well, aren't we assuming that the malach is not inside?
Yeah, but why would he say
so? He's trying to gain entrance by saying, he doesn't know that Elisha knows that he's coming to take his head off. So he's saying, let's talk about this. Look, this is all from the Lord, and guess who you are?
I guess so. It doesn't really fit the next pasuk, though. Perek Zion pasuk Aleph says, Vayomer Elisha, so Elisha responds, Shimu dvar Adonai komar Adonai kei machar sa'at sole p'shekel sa'atayim sorim p'shekel b'shar shomron. So he says, I want you to know that tomorrow's going to get so good. God says tomorrow's going to be so good that the solet, which is semolina in English, a very fine, finely chopped ground grain, as well as barley, is going to be super, super cheap. So instead of a donkey costing 60 shekel or whatever it was, we have a solet, a good deal of solet, probably, I don't know, about 10 liters or so, that costs next to a shekel is like a copper piece. A shekel is a copper piece. I don't know who it is. Vayanash Lish. Well, wait. Hovam Gantin. That's a new character. Really? That's a new character. I'm going to get to him in a second. So, my guess is, the simplest read is like this. So the angel comes, but they clock him out by pushing the door against him. Vayomer, and then who's speaking? Not the malach, but the melech, who shows up hard on his heels and says, stop, stop. I want to talk to you because I recognize that God is doing this, but we have no hope. So he's changed his mind. Instead of killing the Navi, he wants to express, he's not asking the Navi what he could do, that's from he's not, but at least he's expressing the idea that based on how he reads it, there's no hope from God anymore whatsoever, which sounds exactly like what the king said to the woman. So my guess is that the Vayomer in verse 33 is the king. It's all a big confusion, probably because people are running and going, and I think that the author here is trying to give us a sense of this breathlessness and people coming in and people going out and people speaking to each other, and there's everybody who's worried about being killed and dying, and that's the sense one gets. But yeah, I think the simple, just to reiterate this simple idea, the king sends a messenger to kill him, the king then changes his mind, the Navi sees that not only is the king sent somebody to kill him, but the king is changed his mind, therefore he says, I want you to just hold the Malach back for a while, let the king come. The Malach is held back, the king comes, and he says, Elisha, I don't want to kill you, but I'm telling you, I see no hope. And Elisha says exactly the opposite. I'm telling you that you have hope. But then, of course, you have a major philosophical problem, which is, what did the king do deserve a complete change around? One assumes in Navi that Ben-Hadad is winning this battle because of something that Bnei Israel is not doing kosher and therefore deserves to be punished. The next day, he says, whatever situation which we'll see changes, Jews are going to be buying tons of flour for no money whatsoever. The assumption is that the war will be won by the Jewish people. But he never said why. He never says, because you believed in me, because you sacrificed in me, because you hugged and kissed your wife and your kids. It never tells us why there's a change of fortune. One could therefore only assume by the fact that Yehoram, or whoever this was, changed his mind and decided, when bad news comes, I'm not going to kill the prophet, but rather I'm going to... All right, he's not firm enough to ask the prophet what it is he's supposed to do to get firm. But at least he recognizes that, A, God is causing the problems, and that you don't kill the Navi when God causes problems. And perhaps that awakening, honestly, is enough to cause a turnabout in the state of affairs of Israel. Or maybe it was when he ripped his clothes and he had sackcloth underneath. Maybe there's a sense that the king is trying to get somewhere firm-wise, and that Elisha or God is rewarding him to a certain degree for his attempt to come closer to God, even though it's more of a desperation than perhaps actual love. So it's hard to, we could spend hours just on trying to figure out, going over those three psukim, but I think it probably best behooves us to read on. Vayana Shalish, a new character is introduced. So a Shalish is probably a third in command, not a second in command, but a third in command. Where did he come from? I don't know, he shows up out of nowhere. Vayana Shalish Asher HaMelech Nishan Al Yado, who the king rests on his hand. At Ish Elohim, and he speaks to Ish Elohim. Now here it's not being called Elisha. Very curiously, he's being referred to as his titulary, as the Ish Elohim. Vayomer Hine Hashem Oseh Arubah B'Shamayim Hayeh Davar Kazeh. What, God's going to open up holes in the heavens? Is it possible that such a thing can happen? What he's saying is he's mocking Elisha's promise that God is going to make grain come and be plentiful. So you're going to see it, Mr. Shalish, but you're not going to be able to benefit from it, which gives an indication that he is about to die. Shalish is about to die. But the question is, why introduce a character? So the answer is, I don't think this guy is introduced at all. You know who I think this is? We had only one other character which a king rested on him. That term, the king rested on him. Except it wasn't the king of Israel resting on him, it was the king of Aram resting on him. There's a guy named Naaman. Naaman. Take a look back by Naaman, you'll see that Naaman was the second in command of the Syrian forces. And he had leprosy, and he captured a Jewish girl, and the Jewish girl said, why don't you go talk to Elisha? He doesn't want to talk to Elisha, and there's a whole to-do. In the end, things don't work out so well because of Gehazi, and because of Gehazi taking a property that he shouldn't have taken. But at least Naaman goes back and he says, if you remember, at the very end of the Naaman story, he goes, I want to take land from Israel so I can build an altar in Aram so I could only sacrifice to God, who is the God of Israel. My guess, of course I have no proof, except for the fact that A, he's calling him Ish Elohim, which is the same title that he called him back in when he was working for Aram. And second of all, it says, Hu Nishan Al Yado, which it only says by Aram. As far as I know, in all of Tanakh, it only refers to Naaman explicitly in that way, and this unknown guy this way. My guess is Naaman got firm, which we saw happening, and decided to convert and go work for Israel. That's my guess. I can't prove it, of course, because everybody is mysteriously non-named here, but I'm almost positively convinced that this is in fact a Syrian that decided to leave Syria and start working for the Jewish forces. And of course there are stories like that. You have Uri Achiti, who may have been Hittite. You have somebody, Ha'edomites. You always have these people who work for other people's countries. Here I believe this is Naaman, and here I believe Naaman fails to a certain degree. Because Naaman doesn't believe. Now, you know where the word Arubopa Shamayim comes from? That comes from the Mabul. After the Mabul, and God opens up Arubata Shamayim. So what's interesting about this pasuk is the one which is quoted about a guy who loses Tchiyat HaMeitim. Some guy who loses Tchiyat HaMeitim because he doesn't believe in God's reward and punishment. So the question is, why this pasuk? So my only feeling is that this pasuk, if you don't, my assumption is everybody knew Sefer Bereishit. I think everybody, it'd be crazy to think that people didn't know Sefer Bereishit. And this is a direct quote from Sefer Bereishit where it says, God opens up our Arubat HaShamayim. So if you're doubting God's ability to open up our Arubat HaShamayim and let it rain or anything else, then you're not only doubting whether God could perform some miracle or doubting a prophet, you're doubting the entire prehistory of the Jewish people. And that's my mind of why this pasuk is the one cited for by Chazal as being sort of the perfect example of somebody who does not believe that God is able to bring back the dead. Because essentially it throws away all of Sefer Bereishit. So this guy has a lack of faith. In this case, it may be Naaman, which is, he was a convert anyway, so perhaps his conversion wasn't as thorough as it could have been. But anyway, let me continue on.
He would have mocked Elisha, who cured him of leprosy.
I don't know. Maybe, and I'm not sure he's mocking Elisha, maybe as much as he's mocking God. And don't forget, he was the one who didn't believe Elisha in the first place. Elisha said, go dip in the water. He said, what? That dipping in water is going to make me non-leprosy? Please. So the whole thing, I don't know what to tell you. My feeling is that, if you remember, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but Naaman was sort of a failure in the previous time, because they had him where they wanted him, and then Gehazi asked for some extra goods, and Naaman went back home not quite as slim as he should have been, because he thought maybe prophets were just guys who worked for money rather than working out of the goodness of their heart. So here, too, maybe he just doesn't have that positive view of Elisha because of Gehazi. What's interesting is we're about to meet a bunch of unnamed lepers, which Chazal say are Gehazi. So there are a lot of connections between those two stories. But let me continue on. V'arba'a anashim, now all of a sudden we jump. V'arba'a anashim hayam mitzuraim, petach ashar. Chazal say, who are these four lepers? They were none other than Gehazi and his three children, the one who was given leprosy because he dared to take money from Naaman when Naaman had his leprosy taken away. Naaman came to Israel looking for a miracle. Elisha gave him a miracle. Naaman was ready to essentially give him everything and say, here, take money. Elisha says, no, we don't work. We prophets don't work for cash. That's not how Jews do things. And then he sends him home, and Gehazi runs after Naaman and says, you know what? I'll take some money. And that's when Naaman essentially becomes a little less frum, and Elisha puts the leprosy that he essentially took away from Naaman and puts it on to Gehazi. According to Chazal, this is Gehazi and his three children. Is that historical? I don't think necessarily so. There were plenty of lepers at the time. I don't think that it was so uncommon that there weren't lepers living outside the capital city. I think what Chazal is trying to do is try to tie in the Naaman story to this little piece, because I think they see that there's a connection, but I'm going to move ahead. What do we do? Are we going to sit here until we die? What's the point? If we go into the city, we're going to die there. If we stay here, we're going to die here. I mean, it's a lose-lose situation. So we have nothing to lose, and we have nothing to lose. Let us, in this case, nipla el in war means let us surrender. To, is that how the how does the English render that?
We will go over to.
I guess that's right. We will surrender. We'll turn sides. Yeah, we'll go over and surrender to Aram. Im yichayunu nichyeh. So if they'll let us live, they'll live. Those will give us food. The im yimitunu matunu. So if we die, we'll die. So before we had a 0% chance, now we got a 50-50. So the odds are quite clear. We'll go with Aram. Vayakumu b'neshet. They got up at night. Lavol machane Aram. If I have a chance, remind me. It's sort of a historical idea. It doesn't really help the understanding of Sukkim, but it's very interesting. There was something called the Beit HaChofshit, which most major cities had, which is where lepers go. There's a recollection of that in Syrian, in Assyrian and Babylonian documentation as well. It's called the Beit HaChofshit, which is actually referred to a little later in this book. It's very interesting. It was the House of the Dead. and that was where lepers would go. And it was actually a phenomenon in the ancient Near East for lepers outside of capital cities and other cities. So they go to the seed city, and guess what? There's nobody home. They knock, because there's nobody home. Why? Now here the vav is because. Vav can mean a lot of things. It can mean but, and sometimes you have to almost ignore it. Here it means because. Va donai, because God, hishmiat machane aram, kol rechev kol sus, kol chayel gadol, vayomru ish lachav, hine sachar aleinu melech Yisrael, malchei achitim, malchei mitzrayim avo aleinu. What they had said, what the Syrians, what the Aramites had said, is they heard this great sound of war. They thought that maybe the king of Israel was smart enough to hire mercenaries, the Hittites who lived in Asia Minor, and the Egyptians, of course, who lived in Egypt, and they're going to come to us. Vayakumu vayanusu baneshef, they ran away. Vayazru et ha'olayem v'yatuzehem v'chamarehem machaneh kasher hi, they left everything exactly was. Vayanusu al nasham, they ran for their lives. Now I know this, whenever people read this in Tanakh, they always think, you know, not really. So I know, like, you know, no, there's no way that a whole camp would simply scatter. So all I could do is tell the story quickly that I know I've told before about the time that I was in the Golan Heights and I was on guard duty at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm looking over a mountain towards Syria, and I had my hand on the siren, and all of a sudden there's this fire that comes up over the mountain, this massive fire. And I was literally, I was so scared. I was scared out of my mind. I almost had a siren right next to me. I was going to be makpitz the entire. I would have sent the entire forces of the Ramat Golan rolling towards the Syrian border. That is, I had, you know, war and peace was in my particular hands, and I had my hands on it. And I saw this fire coming up the mountain. I'm like, I know they're attacking us, and I just waited just an extra second, and it was the moon. It was the moon that came over the mountain, and the reason why it looked like fire is because you had like these clouds, you know, like these clouds that spread out, so the glow of the clouds. I spread out, so I saw like there was the black mountain, and over it was the fire. And I have to tell you, I was so scared, because when you're about 5 miles from the Syrian border, and you're in the middle of war, and that's what you're doing, and in the middle of the night, and you haven't slept that much anyway, things go horribly, horribly wrong. Right. Whether you live or die is based on your responsibility. So these things don't shock me at all. When I was a kid, I never understood these stories, and God made a sound. I mean, one, so let them use binoculars and see what's going on. But the truth is, as you saw, it happened towards nighttime. That's why the Torah is emphasizing it. Things go crazy during war. Of course, there's the famous Davidka story. You all know the Davidka story, which is the Davidka Square, and they fired off this incredibly lousy mortar, but it was incredibly noisy, and it scared away the troops. And also, a friend of mine who was in the tank corps also told me such a story. He didn't tell it about his own tank corps, so it's secondhand, but he was in the Lebanon War. His name was Avi Trice, and he told me the story. He said what they did was they were in big trouble at one point during the Lebanon War, so they took the mufflers off the tanks. They took the mufflers off the tanks in an attack, and it made a hellish noise, and the Syrian forces thought that there were twice or three times as many tanks as there were, and they scattered. It was maybe a company of tanks, maybe 10 tanks. They probably thought there were 30 or 40 tanks, and they all got out of town. So that's a secondhand story, but it was a story told for me, who was somebody who was in Mohammed Shalek, who was in the Lebanon War. So these things happen. I mean, war is a funny thing. People look at war and they see miracles. Some people see miracles, and some people see tactics, and some people see both. So again, as a kid, these things bother me. Having served in the Israeli army, these things don't bother me much anymore at all. Anyway, let me go on. We probably won't be able to finish the chapter, but we'll see where we get to. Verse 8. So they come to the edge of the camp, and they go into one of the tents. So they sit down and they have a nice meal. Like, nobody's home, I'm going to sit and have a nice meal. They take out of there silver and gold and clothes. And they hide it. Now, this, I want to mention that this is, again, I think Elisha is writing this. Elisha himself. This is what they call the Sefer Elisha. It's so beautifully written. In the last 6-7 chapters, you've seen all kind of motifs that are beautifully repeated over and over again. Here, what you have is, first of all, the word Vayatminu, which repeats the word of the woman who was hiding her child. So there's just now I don't even know what he's trying to say. In many cases, I've said Elisha uses stuff from Bereishit, he uses stuff from Shmos. Sometimes I just think it because he's just a really good writer, so he uses these words over and over again to create a sense of consistency, to use the similar words so that they. It's like when you say a word at in a good poetry, when you experience a word. Let's say I say a rose, and I give you all kinds of smells about the rose, and I describe it. And then later on in the story, I say she was like a rose to me. I don't have to repeat all the things that the rose smells like, because essentially it's brought back in. You see what I'm saying? That's great art, great poetry. What great poetry does, great writing does, is it sets up a knowledge base, and then it could tweak the knowledge base, and the more you go on, the more and more it tweaks, and it's able to bring back memories of the things that you've smelled before. So here too, it's just this beautiful writing where Elisha is able to really bring back the flavor of the story. And there's a theme, not only is a motif the same, this idea of hiding things, we're going to see there's a similar theme to what these lepers do and what the king does. And I'll show you that in a second. What do? They go into another tent. I guess they don't eat again because they're full. And they hide the stuff. They figure, we want it, it's all ours. Vayomu isha reyehu. But then everybody said to each other, lo chein anachnu osim. We're doing the wrong thing. Hayom hazeh yom b'sorahu. This is not a day for stealing. It's a day for telling tales. Vanachnu machshim, and we're keeping quiet. V'chikinu ador abokhor matza'anu avon. We're going to wait till the morning, and what will be found in us is a sin. That this will be found out to be wrong. But I don't think they're just saying that we're going to be guilty. Maybe nobody will know that they stole the stuff. Just, we'll have done a sin. The word avon itself is very indicative of a spiritual sin.
You think they're talking about having hidden the stuff?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. That is, they're spending time making profits.
They just haven't told everyone else the good news.
They kept it themselves.
No, I think it's not only that they haven't told. It's the very hiding. It's not like, look, they could have spent an hour and a half hiding all the stuff and then run back to the city.
Mm-hmm.
But what they actually, the emphasis is they were hiding the stuff and then they're saying, lo chein mashanach osim. I don't think they're referring to just the fact that they're not telling. I think it's the stealing.
I think it's the fact that they're stealing the stuff, stealing and hiding the stuff rather than telling.
True.
I mean, look at
what are we doing with our time?
But remember,
they were focused on ourselves.
Rather
than going telling all of Shomron, all of Israel, that, hey, the Aramites have left, what are we doing? We're being greedy and putting stuff away for ourselves.
Correct, yes, exactly
rather,
right.
Rather than sharing
working for the people, which is what Elisha's been about since day number one. He's been trying to transform a people that were, I dodged the bullet, or not in my backyard, essentially. And he's been trying to get people to work for the very first miracle where he told the woman that, you know how much oil you'll get? It depends on how many people you go to and ask them for pots, for empty pots. The more friends you make, the more oil you'll get. The idea of what Elisha's doing is that people wake up and say, you know what, we're only interested in ourselves. We were ready to give ourselves over to the Aramites just to survive, to abandon our own people. And you know what? Let's stop being selfish and being individualistic. Let's work for the greater good of the people rather than the good of the individual, which is what Elisha is all about. That's the motif of Elisha all the way through.
Well, what about if they were nervous that if they didn't tell,
they would get caught?
They would get caught.
Yeah, it's possible to read. It could say, Mitza'anu Avon, which means in the morning, Mitza'anu Avon, we will have found a sin, could mean theoretically that people will find a sin in us. Although it's not. That would be nimtzanu ba'avon, not matza'anu, we will find the sin. Nonetheless, one could read it like that, Herb. There's no doubt that one could read it still selfishly. I prefer not to, because I see the same theme going over where the king thinks, you know, I'm going to kill the prophet, and then he says, wait a second, maybe I could salvage something out of this. And here, too, the people are just working for themselves, and all of a sudden they're thinking, maybe we could do something for the greater good of the people. It's not impossible to read this in a more negative sense, but I think grammatically it's a little difficult to read it that way, but also I think it misses the theme of what Elisha is trying to tell you. Here are selfish people who were born selfish and live selfish, and all of a sudden they're thinking about the other guy. That's what I get out of the story. Let's continue on. Ve'ata. Lucha v'navoa, let us go and let us come, which by the way is a term that's used very often with Elisha's writing. Lucha v'navo, go and come. V'nagida beit hamelch, let's go tell the king. V'yavo v'ikru el shoer ha'ir, so they come to the guard of the city, the gate guard. V'agidu lahem, the great guardians, V'agidu lahem le'mor banu el machane Aram b'inei ein sham ish v'kol adam him susim asur v'chamur asur v'olim kasher hema. There ain't no people, there are horses tied up, there are donkeys tied up, and the tents are exactly as they are, were left off. Vayikra shoarim, vayagidu beit ha-melech pnima, so they tell the king, vayakal melech laila vayomer lamadab. So the king gives up, he says, agidin alachem, I'll tell you what's going on. Et asher asu lanu Aram, it's a trick, I'll tell you what Aram is doing to us. Yadu kirevim anachlu, they know we're starving. The etzumin alachem alechavet b'sadeh, they're all hiding in the fields, leimor, ki etzumin ha'ir, but it's the same chayim ala'ir v'navo. As soon as we come out to get the food, they're going to jump us. Which, by the way, is very similar to the king by Naaman. Naaman says, I'm sending you a letter, I want to be healed, and the king suspects that it's a plot to kill him, which is why I also think that this happened shortly after Naaman's story. Vayanacha mi'avadava yomer v'ichu chamisha susima nisharim asher nisharuba hinam kol hamon Yisrael asher nisharuba hinam kol hamon Yisrael asher tamun shulchanirah. Again, a jumble of words, so I'll just quickly sum them up. There ain't no horses left anyway. And there's no people left anyway, which means we have nothing to lose. Only got 5 horses left anyway. Let's take them out before the old croak of starvation anyway. And you know all those people you're talking about who you're trying to save their lives of? They're all dying anyway. We got nothing to lose. Let's go. So in verse 14, Vayichushne Rechav Susim, the question is, why do they take only 2? I don't know. What happened to the other 3? I don't know. Vayishtacha Melech, maybe the king was being careful. I don't know. It's hard to say. I'm going to just rush through. I hope you apologize, but I think it behooves us to finish the story. Which means they not only go out to the camp, but they also track them towards the Jordan River, and everybody is tossing aside goods, which I never understood either, by the way, until I was in a race. I was in a 10K race. And I had a bottle of water, and I was on the last K. And you want to know something? A bottle of water that you're holding when you want to really keel over weighs 1,000 pounds. So you, when you are like on your last breath, I thought, you know, I'm so used to running, and then on the last day where I was running out of breath, that water, oh! And when I threw it away, I was like, I can run now. So the idea of people throwing away anything and everything when they're running desperately also makes sense to me. In any event,
airplanes get rid of the fuel sometimes.
Yeah.
And I have to.
There's something psychological about weight. When you are desperately running and tired and exhausted, not just running, but fleeing, every pound weighs even more. So this is something I understand better now, having been a runner for a little bit. So they go and they pillage they take all the booty. And exactly what God said would happen. They now have all the flour they need, and the price drops out. So anybody who was trying to corner the market on Solet before then has just lost everything, because the market has just plummeted on Solet. Whoever was going long on Solet is now broke. Whoever was shorting Solet is now very rich. So he tells the guy, the shalish, and again it uses the word Hashem Nishan Yadol, it's got to be Naaman, it's so Naaman. He says, you guard the city gate. They ran right over him. It was like a rock concert thing where they all these horrible story, well, stampede, it's horrible. This is very unusual. What you're looking at is it's repeated. The story's repeated. Very unusual. Usually the Navi tells what's going to happen. Then when it actually happens, it usually just says, and this is what happened based on what the Navi said. But here in verse 18 and 19, it repeats what the Navi said. The Navi said that everything's going to be cheap. The Shalish said, I don't believe you. God can't do such a thing. And the Navi says, Vayomer hincharo ebeinech misham lo tochel. You'll see it, but you won't be able to eat it because obviously you're going to get trampled to death. Why these two psukim are repeated verbatim, literally verbatim, I don't know. Vayi lo chein vayir misu oto ha'am bashar vayamot. And the story ends that they trampled him and he died. I just wanted somebody, I know we're a few minutes over time, but I wanted to just sum up the theme. If this is Naaman, something is happening with the Jewish people. There is a salvation based on what the king does or what the people are trying to accomplish. there's a sense of the people getting together, and for some reason, if this is Naaman, Naaman decides to become killed. It's like one of those beloved characters on it in 24, and you like them very much, and then they die. The question is, why would you want to kill off Naaman? If it is Naaman, and I think it is Naaman, the guy who leans, the general, the king leans on him, it can't be anybody, it strikes me as only possibly Naaman. Why would you want to kill Naaman? So, I don't know, it could be that once Naaman, maybe Naaman's only purpose was to serve as an intermediary between Aramite forces and the Jews. He was never supposed to become Jewish. He was supposed to stay a nice, righteous Gentile who believed in God, who brought the Jews close together with their enemies, who were the Aramites. It could be that once he decides to become Jewish, so now he's going to be treated, well, he was being treated like an Aramite. What? He's not a bridge, and now we're going to treat him like any other Jew, and if there's a Jew who says, I don't believe in God, I don't believe God could do this, so he'll get punished like everybody else get punished. It reminds a little bit of Yonah. Yonah goes to Nineveh, and he says he doesn't want to know to Nineveh. So there's a famous question, which is, why didn't Yonah want to go? Because the non-Jews don't have to do much, and they seem to get forgiven, 1, 2, 3, and we don't. And the answer is, you're right. That's the way it works. There is a different standard. When Naaman was working for, what's that? For better or worse, you have responsibilities. It cuts both ways. When Naaman was a non-Jew working for Syria, so he had a job. When he gave up that job to become a Jewish guy, working not as the second in command, which he was in Aram, but the third in command, the Shalish, in Israel. So then he's judged like anybody else. You want to be Jewish, Naaman, you'll play it like everybody else plays it. Otherwise, I don't really understand exactly what the point is. It ends on that note. It ends on the note. And of course, the other possibility is it simply ends the note, which is don't doubt God, which is a pretty straightforward, it's like almost a classic pulpit speech. It's almost a cliche, but maybe it wasn't a cliche here, but it was being written for the first time. The idea was doubt God. If God wants to open up holes in the heaven and rain down semolina, he'll open up holes in the heaven and rain down semolina, which is something whoever the shalish was did not understand, and apparently the king does understand. So anyway, we'll get to that's the end of the story. We did actually, believe it or not, this is a story about the rich woman. Verse chapter 8, 1 to verse about 15. Is the story, verse 6 was the rich woman who we met before, the very rich woman from Shunem, and the end of the story, Gehazi shows up again. We're going to skip that, we'll go to verse 7 with the terrible mission that that Elisha has to perform, which is about the last thing Elisha will do, and then we'll finish, that essentially wraps up what we call the Book of Elisha, which is a mini book inside the Book of Kings. Anyway, thank you for coming, I'm sorry for rushing the last 15 verses.